first-ever prescription depressant hit the shelves today. Approved by the FDA last month, Despondex is intended as a treatment for the approximately 20 million Americans who are insufferably cheery. Tests prove the drug is effective at reducing a range of symptoms, from squealing loudly when a friend calls to use of the phrase cool beans and excessive hugging. Dr. Alman Way calls the drug a huge step forward in the battle against exuberance.
If you're in a good mood every so often, well, that's fine. That's normal. This is for those that have a persistent positive outlook on life.
Eva Hendry of New Haven, Connecticut began participating in a clinical trial of Despondex 6 weeks ago.
I was always telling people how cute their outfits were and bringing them little gifts. I'd beam at anyone who made eye contact with me. I didn't realize life didn't have to be like that.
Eva said she never knew how her annoyingly chipper attitude was affecting those around her.
Over and over again, I'd ask Jeff to ride his bike down to the botanical garden with me, no matter how many times he said no.
And she was always smiling, but I didn't know what to do to help her.
I used to think, why am I the only one trying to set up single friends with each other? And now I realize it. I was sick. I need a treatment.
Eva says the drug may have saved their marriage.
Now Jeff and I can just waste a night sitting on the couch, watching a TV show neither of us enjoy. Like a regular couple.
Not everyone is convinced that Despondex is the cure-all for perkiness, however. In this week's Time magazine, Michael Pelosic of UCLA argues that many patients get similar results from natural remedies, something as simple as a diet of corn syrup and white bread and a total lack of exercise. But Dr. Way disagrees.
We have to erase the stigma attached with getting chirpy people help, real medical help. I mean, do you know what it's like to be around these people? It's pretty annoying.
Doctors estimate the new drug could reduce the number of costume or theme parties in the U.S. by up to 40%.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound, a dimension of sight, a dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into...
I have sent to the Congress today a series of proposals to help fight mental illness and mental retardation. These two afflictions have been long neglected. They occur more frequently, affect more people, require more prolonged treatment, cause more individual and family suffering than any other condition in American life. It has been tolerated too long. It has troubled our national conscience. But only as a problem unpleasant to mention, easy to postpone, and despairing of solution. The time has come for a great national effort. New medical, scientific, and social tools and insights are now available. With respect to mental illness, our chief aim is to get people out of state custodial institutions and back into their communities and homes without hardship or danger. Today, nearly one-fifth of the 279 state mental institutions are fire and health hazards. Three-fourths of them were opened before World War II. Nearly half of the 530,000 persons in our state mental hospitals are in institutions with over 3,000 patients, getting little or no individual treatment. Many of these institutions have less than half of the professional staff required. 45% of them have been hospitalized for 10 years or more. If we launch a broad new mental health program now, it will be possible within a decade or two to reduce the number of patients now under custodial care by 50% or more. Mental retardation ranks with mental health as a major health, social, and economic problem in this country. It strikes our most precious asset, our children. It disables 10 times as many people as diabetes, 20 times as many as tuberculosis, and 600 times as many as infantile paralysis. There are between 5 and 6 million mentally retarded children and adults, an estimated 3% of our population, much too high for a country of our resources and wealth. There are many causes, many of them still unknown. But I think that statistics already point to a direct relationship between lack of prenatal care and mental retardation. Primarily for lack of funds, between 20 and 60% of the mothers receiving care in public hospitals in some large cities receive inadequate or no prenatal care. and mental retardation is more prevalent in these areas. I am recommending a new 5-year program of assistance to states and local health departments to develop comprehensive maternity and child health care programs, serving primarily families who are otherwise unable to pay for needed medical care. We as a nation have neglected too long the mentally ill and the mentally retarded. It affects all of us, and it affects us as a country. I am hopeful that beginning today, this country will move with a great national effort in this field so vital to the welfare of our citizens.
I was doing fine, once upon a time, then my brain left and it didn't say bye. Don't look at me wrong, I'm out of my mind. Yeah. Like Nostradamus and Da Vinci combined. Yeah. So paranoid of espionage, I'm watching my doors and checking my times. My brain's on vacation, they're telling me. Yeah. And I'm bipolar to the severity. And I need medication, apparently. And some electric convulsive therapy. I am a rebel, but yes, I'm so militant. Still I'm eligible for disabilities. I am psychotic, but there is no remedy. This is not figurative, this is literally.
In May 1998, 15-year-old Kip Kinkle murdered his parents and two classmates, as well as injuring 25 others, after engaging in a shooting spree that ended up in his school's cafeteria. In the investigation, it emerged that he had been taking popular antidepressant medication Prozac since the summer of the previous year. In December 2000, Michael McDermott went on a shooting rampage at his workplace, Edgewater Technologies, killing 7 of his co-workers. During his trial, the court heard testimony that in the weeks before the shooting, McDermott had tripled the dosage of his antidepressant medication, Prozac, from 70 milligrams per day to 210 milligrams. In March 2005, 16-year-old Jeff Weiss shot and killed 9 people, including 5 students at Red Lake Senior High School in Minnesota, before turning the gun on himself. It was later revealed he had been undergoing treatment for depression and had been on Prozac at the time. In September 2008, Finnish post-secondary student Matti Saari shot and killed 10 other students on campus before killing himself. The official Finnish government report on the incident revealed that he had been taking an SSRI medication at the time of the shooting. SSRI stands for Selective Serotonin Reuptake Inhibitor, and it is a class of drugs that is often used to treat depression and anxiety. It includes Prozac, Zoloft, Celexa, Paxil, and a host of other commonly prescribed antidepressants. And the perpetrators of a raft of school shootings, mass murders, and other violent incidents in recent years have been taking them. And so it was perhaps not surprising when the culprit of this month's mass shooting at Fort Hood, specialist Ivan Lopez, turned out to be taking unnamed antidepressants himself.
We have very strong evidence that he had a medical history that indicates unstable psychiatric or psychological condition.
Lopez had been prescribed powerful antidepressants and the sleep drug Ambien. He was getting help. Dr. Javier Amador interviewed Major Nidal Hassan, who killed 13 people here at Fort Hood in 2009. Mental health issues, he says, must be aggressively treated, particularly when antidepressants are given.
You have to be very cautious and take care to be aware of which symptoms are improving more quickly than others. People's motivation comes back, their ability to sleep comes back, they feel more energy, but they're still feeling hopeless and suicidal.
If these go dumb, I go to the mental facility. See, men I'm so out there, I slap eyes with E.T. I don't need a feature, they don't want my eat on my like heart when I'm on this beat. If you feel the same as me, then you gotta agree. I'm out of my mind, out of my mind, out of my f***ing mind.
Although it is yet to be reported, and may in fact never be revealed, precisely what type of antidepressant Lopez was taking, or whether it was an SSRI, the number of confirmed SSRI shooters in recent years has raised the question of a causal link between the medication and incidents of violence. Although the drug manufacturers are quick to downplay this connection as anecdotal or coincidental.
Too often people like to assume, they project, they make a little bit of logic, and they say, whoa, that could theoretically explain a large problem. That's faulty logic.
Boca Raton psychiatrist Abby Strauss says linking SSRI discontinuation to violence is
oversimplistic, and he calls spreading the theory, quote, scary.
Mounting scientific evidence points to a strong correlation between the use of psychiatric drugs in general, and SSRIs in particular, and violent behavior. In 2010, the Public Library of Science published a study titled Prescription Drugs Associated with Reports of Violence Towards Others, which examined how 484 drugs were associated with 1,937 documented cases of violent behavior. Of those 484 drugs, 31 of them were responsible for 79% of the violence, including 11 antidepressants. When incidents of school massacres in the U.S. are charted against prescription of psychiatric medication, the correlation is undeniable. Further research is needed to establish if there is a causal linkage between these pharmaceuticals and the incidents of violence, but critics of the big pharmaceutical manufacturers complain such research is hampered by the low standards for reporting that these companies are held to.
What's your name, B.O.B., so they calling you Bob? Stop playing, nigga, you know that I'm known for the Bob. Couple hit songs, got you thinking you a heartthrob. Well, this thing's so good, like a nigga wanna solve. You don't need a feature, cause I'm the feature. You gon' be the priest, and I'ma be the preacher. You gon' be the him, I'ma be the shira. You gon' be the grim, I'ma be the reaper.
Airplanes in the night skies like shooting stars.
Well, you gon' really need a wish right now when my goons come through and start shooting stars. You know I'm all about shoes and cars. I'm kinda drunk for a booze Bacardi. I told baby when I get my new Vans and my blow that motherfucker on a blue Bugatti. You know I graduated summa cum laude. That's why they thinking I'm Illuminati.
As a matter of fact, let's kiss and make up. I'll help you escape from my blue Ducati.
One such critic, David Healy, author of over 150 peer-reviewed papers in the field of psychiatry and the author of numerous books, including Pharmageddon, joined me on the Corbett Report last week to discuss this issue. And you have, for example, on davidhealy.org, your own website, you have an article on the 25th anniversary of the introduction of Prozac, how Prozac has changed psychiatry since it was first approved. And in that, you list the startling fact that there are probably something between 1,000 to 1,500 extra suicides in the U.S. each year triggered by an antidepressant, an extra 2,000 to 2,500 in Europe, and there are probably between 1,000 and 1,500 extra episodes of violence in the U.S. each year, and an extra 2,000 to 2,500 extra episodes in Europe, which is a startling figure to be pinned down towards one class of drugs. How can we make that linkage, and why is that not more well-known amongst the general public?
Well, the linkage comes from my access to the clinical trial data that was used to bring drugs like Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, and the other drugs in the SSRI group of drugs to the market. Most doctors generally haven't got to see all of the clinical trial data behind these drugs. One of the unique things that we've got at the moment is that if I was to make a claim about a drug saying that I've got a drug that will be useful treatment for the flu or asthma or whatever, and didn't let people see the data behind my claim, like for instance, if you were asking me on this program now, okay, that's fine that you make this claim, but show me the data. If I refuse to show you the data, it will be the end of my career. If I refuse to show my academic colleagues the data, it will be the end of my career. But the pharmaceutical industry get to hold the data back, and they only drip feed out to people the data that they want you to see. Now, I've been an expert witness in some legal cases that have involved this group of drugs in the case of people who have become homicidal or become suicidal. And because of that, I've had access to clinical trial data that a lot of other people haven't seen. And once you get to see that data and add it up, that's the data that underpins the estimate that there could be up to 1,000 or 2,000 people going on to become suicidal or are possibly homicidal in the United States, and the same number in Europe. The reason a lot of other people don't say the same kind of things is they still haven't had access to the data. They see me saying these things, but they feel, I guess, that it isn't enough to see a person like David Healy say these things for us to believe it. We have to see the data with our own eyes before we'll be prepared to believe it. Except, of course, if the kinds of things that I say that I've just said to you now, for instance, or that you've just read out from the blog posting, if I've got it wrong, I'm going to be sued by the pharmaceutical companies. I mean, so I think people can take from the fact that I haven't been sued and I feel able to say these kind of things, that actually there is data there. They can't see it, but there is data there to support these claims.
I'm out of it, I can't seem to come out of it. What's going on inside of my head? It feels like I'm being John Malkovich. Ladies and gentlemen, please tone it down a bit. There's an announcement I'd like to read. Wait, how am I supposed to pronounce this?
Further complicating the issue is the fact that the general public is often, as in the case of the Fort Hood shooter, left in a state of limbo regarding the medical history of the perpetrators of these mass shooting events. Often stories are reported with vague and unconfirmed details about antidepressants, or sometimes just medication. It can be difficult for the average person to sort through the daily reports of adverse and violent effects of these types of drugs. One website that helps in that effort is SSRIstories.org. Begun in the 1990s, it is a repository of over 5,000 news articles in which prescription drugs are linked to adverse events, including incidents of violence. Last week, Julie Wood, one of the proprietors of the site, joined me to discuss the problem of sorting through the often incomplete information from these reports.
Well, when we talk about complications when it comes to exploring these issues, I think another complication is, of course, that medical histories are generally kept private even after the death of the people involved in these stories, so we only ever come at it from the outside perspective, usually based on what we find in media reports. I'm not sure if SSRI Stories does any independent or other types of vetting, or if there's other ways to get information about any of these, the people involved in these stories, but I've found, for example, in the past, I found lists of mass shooters who were on some type of antidepressant, and when I tried to verify some of the people and what was their medical history, what drugs were they taking, how do we know this, there are people on those lists that I've seen that I can't in any way verify were on any type of psychotic medication. So I don't know where some of these lists come from, I don't know how we access this information. Have you encountered that type of problem when it comes to documenting some of these cases?
Definitely.
I don't need a soft, I don't need this bigger, cause I'm bring the noise like an onomatopoeia. Leave him in the dust, all I see is my Adidas. Nene boo boo, wouldn't wanna be a. Never turn it back, how you think I got here? And I'm never slowing down.
Was that a deer?
If you got a problem, step to the office. Matter of fact, never mind, talk to the kiosk. Biatch, you have no idea. That's why they call me B-Dot. Been a maniac ever since I was knee-high. Man, I swear I gotta need help. Someone call Charter, maybe call FEMA. Cause I gotta be crazy, out of my mind to have this many steps in my visa.
What we're talking about is mostly the U.S., and one of the things I've learned is that every state has different legislation with respect to privacy in terms of crime scene photos and toxicology reports and autopsy reports. And it ranges from everything from it's public information to that it is totally sealed. And then in between, there's some states that allow some access to people with, quote, legitimate interests, like a researcher. We have I've made some links and my husband's made some links with researchers in other countries where coroner's reports and toxicology reports are available. And I have read a lot of those and I've talked to the people and seen the data from some of those. And that is really fascinating because one of the things I learned there, and to just to divert a little bit, is you go to all the SSRI deaths, so you look at the deaths where SSRIs have been involved, and case after case after case, you see the coroner saying, well, you know, he hanged himself, but we can't be sure that it was deliberate. You go, what? And you read so many of these things that you start to think, well, no wonder the suicide rate hasn't changed. Nobody's counting suicides as suicides. So that's one thing I picked up from that. But your original point about the jurisdictional issues on privacy making it very difficult to uncover some of the truth is very true.
In the final equation, the question of the causal linkage between SSRIs and indeed other forms of psychiatric drugs and incidents of violence needs to be taken seriously. There are many factors at play here, from differences in individual reactions to the fact that people who are more likely to commit violent acts in the first place are often the people who are prescribed these drugs. But the threat of violence has been taken seriously enough that the FDA in the US, the Ministry of Health in Japan, and other similar bodies in countries around the world have added a warning in their guidelines for antidepressants. According to the Japanese Ministry of Health, there are cases where we cannot rule out a causal relationship of hostility, anxiety, and sudden acts of violence with the medication. And in the FDA formulation, antidepressant medicines may increase suicidal thoughts or action in some children, teenagers, and young adults within the first few months of treatment.
Wait, if I'm here and you're there, and I'm here and you're there, and I'm here and you're there, and if I'm here and you're there, and 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 I'm here and you're there, and
you're right there. Yeah.
How can it be seen to be a good thing for anyone but the drug manufacturers themselves that these drugs have been on the market for decades, and the bodies in charge of regulating them still can only offer such wishy-washy, non-evidence-based statements? The issue of drug-linked violence is one that we as a society need to start discussing and acting on soon. Otherwise, we will continue to let the status quo be ruled, not by doctors or patients or their loved ones, and certainly not by the victims of these mass murders, but by the men in the boardrooms of these pharmaceutical companies who have been shown time and time again to care about nothing other than their own bottom line.
Hold on. So you're telling me that Bayer knew that this drug was infected with the AIDS virus, they yanked it from the market in America, and then they dumped it in markets overseas?
They had to figure out a way, Joe, to make a profit on a product that they could not sell in America. So they made a huge profit. They dropped the product in Japan, Spain, and France. By the way, Joe, government officials in France that allowed that to happen actually had to go to prison for it. In America, not one corporate executive for this company has been indicted or even criminally investigated by our Justice Department.
Why not?
Moving on, there are over 1.5 million diagnosed paranoid schizophrenics living in America today. Should our healthcare system be doing more to make sure they are safe to themselves and others by watching over them 24 hours a day?
Yes, we need to monitor these people to make sure they're safe. Hide cameras everywhere they go, in the street, in their homes, in the eyes of people at the convenience stores where they shop.
Cameras aren't really enough.
I read it in a medical journal recently that a number of doctors have already begun to place microscopic tracking devices under the skin of schizophrenics, which is a great way to make sure that they don't get lost.
Yeah, and this article said here recently that most of them have had no problem with that, and it's a very non-invasive procedure and has proven to work very well.
Painless.
So far.
Yeah. Painless,
schizophrenics often respond well to pleasant memories from their past, and one technique which might give them a little bit of relief is if we have their caregivers' faces surgically reconstructed, so they look like the schizophrenic's dead relatives.
Mm. Now, some say that we should offer verbal encouragement by implanting speakers in their ears, which would whisper kind words to them 24 hours a day.
Couldn't agree more. I think what would be great would be a recorded voice on a loop saying, everyone around you wants to get you, in reference to help.
Of course, we can't have just one voice. We need to have more than one voice, because then they know it's a team effort.
That's right. They feel supported by the community, and that's what we really should be going
right.
for.
But we have to do more than just calm them. You know, we have to give them practical advice, too. If I tell them which bus drivers hate them, which manholes are covering up underground government prisons,
right.
which statues don't love them anymore, you know, that sort of thing.
This kind of technology would be expensive. Some people have said to slip it into their minds subconsciously, perhaps through coded anagrams that, let's say, we would hide or encrypt into books.
Definitely. They'll think that they're just reading, you know, standard literature, but actually it will be encoded instructions from people who want to help them.
In newspapers, or inside the tattoos of people on the street.
Just the ingredients on a box of cereal, anything that they might read.
And this is an area where I think that we could really get some help from the government. We could be using the stealth planes and helicopters to be tracking those paranoid schizophrenics as they're going through their daily lives.
We already have the ability to make everything that's the color red signal data and images back to the government's underground bunkers. And we should be using this technology to help these people.
Well, now, in regard to this problem of the ultimate revolution,
This has been very well summed up by the moderator. In the past, we can say that all revolutions have essentially aimed at changing the environment in order to change the individual. I mean, there's been the political revolution, the economic revolution. In the time of the Reformation, the religious revolution, all these aimed, as I say, not directly at the human being, but at his surroundings, so that by modifying the surroundings, you did achieve, at one remove, an effect upon the human being. Today, we are faced, I think, with the approach of what may be called the ultimate revolution, the final revolution, where a man can act directly on the mind-body of his fellows. Well, needless to say, some kind of direct action on human mind-bodies has been going on since the beginning of time. But this has generally been of a violent nature. The techniques of terrorism have been known from time immemorial, and people have employed them with more or less ingenuity, sometimes with the utmost crudity, sometimes with a good deal of skill acquired by a process of trial and error, finding out what the best ways of using torture, imprisonment, constraints of various kinds. But as I think it was Metternich said many years ago, you can do everything with bayonets except sit on them. That if you are going to control any population for any length of time, you must have some measure of consent. It's exceedingly difficult to see how pure terrorism can function indefinitely. It can function for a fairly long time, but I think sooner or later you have to bring in an element of persuasion, an element of getting people to consent to what is happening to them. Well, it seems to me that the nature of the ultimate revolution with which we are now faced is precisely this, that we are in process of developing a whole series of techniques which will enable the controlling oligarchy, who have always existed and presumably always will exist, to get people actually to love their servitude. This is seems to me the ultimate in malevolent revolution, shall we say. And this is a problem which has interested me for many years, and about which I wrote 30 years ago a fable, The Brave New World, which is essentially the account of a society making use of all the devices at that time available, and some of the devices which I imagined to be possible, making use of them in order to, first of all, to standardize the population, to iron out inconvenient human differences, to create, so to say, mass-produced models of human beings arranged in some kind of a scientific caste system. And since then I have continued to be extremely interested in this problem, and I have noticed with increasing dismay that a number of the predictions which were purely fantastic when I made them 30 years ago have come true, or seem in process of coming true, that a number of techniques about which I talked seem to be here already, and that there seems to be a general movement in the direction of this kind of ultimate revolution, this method of control by which people can be made to enjoy a state of affairs which, by any decent standard, they ought not to enjoy. The enjoyment of servitude.
Remember when you ran away and I got on my knees and begged you not to leave because I go berserk? Well, you left me anyhow, and then the days got worse and worse, and now you see I've gone completely out of my mind. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha, they're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha, to the funny farm, where life is beautiful all the time, and I'll be happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats, and they're coming to take me away, ha-ha! You thought it was a joke, and so you laughed when I had said that losing you would make me flip my lid. Right? You know you laughed, I heard you laugh. You laughed, you laughed, and laughed, and then you left. But now you know I'm utterly mad. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha. They're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha. To the happy home with trees and flowers and chirping birds and basket weavers who sit and smile and twiddle their thumbs and toes. And they're coming to take me away, I cooked your food, I cleaned your house, and this is how you pay me back for all my kind, unselfish, loving deeds. Ha! Well, you just wait, they'll find you yet, and when they do, they'll put you in the ASPCA, you mangy mutt! And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha, they're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha, to the funny farm, where life is beautiful all the time, and I'll be happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats, and they're coming to take me away, ha-ha, to the happy home, with trees and flowers and chirping birds and basket weavers who sit and smile and twiddle their thumbs and toes, and they're coming to take me away,
This process, as I say, has gone on for over the years, and I become more and more interested in what is happening. And here I would like briefly to compare the parable of Brave New World with another parable which was put forth more recently. In George Orwell's book, 1984, Orwell wrote his book between 45 and 48, at the time when the Stalinist terror regime was still in full swing, and just after the collapse of the Hitlerian terror regime. And his book, which I admire greatly, is a book of very great talent and extraordinary ingenuity, shows, it's so to say a projection into the future of the immediate past, of what for him was the immediate past, and the immediate present. It was a projection into the future of a society where control was exercised wholly by terrorism and the violent attacks upon the mind body of individuals. Whereas my own book, which was written in 1932, when there was only a mild dictatorship in the form of Mussolini in existence, was not overshadowed by the idea of terrorism, and I was therefore free, in a way which Orwell was not free, to think about these other methods of control, these non-violent methods. And I'm inclined to think that the scientific dictatorships of the future, and I think there are going to be scientific dictatorships in many parts of the world, will be probably a good deal nearer to the Brave New World pattern than to the 1984 pattern. They will be a good deal nearer, not because of any humanitarian qualms in the scientific dictators, but simply because the Brave New World pattern is probably a good deal more efficient than the other. That if you can get people to consent to the state of affairs in which they are living, the state of servitude, the state of being, having their differences ironed out and being made amenable to mass production methods on the social level, if you can do this, then you are likely to have a much more stable and much more lasting society, a much more easily controllable society than you would if you were relying wholly on clubs and firing squads and concentration camps. So that my own feeling is that the 1984 picture was tinged, of course, by the immediate past and the present in which Orwell was living, but that the past and present of those years does not represent, I feel, the likely trend of what is going to happen. Needless to say, we shall never get rid of terrorism. This will always find its way to the surface. But I think that insofar as dictators become more and more scientific, more and more concerned with a technically perfectly running society, they will be more and more interested in the kind of techniques which I imagined and described from existing realities in Brave New World. So that it seems to me then that this ultimate revolution is really not very far away, that we already a number of the techniques for bringing about this kind of control are here, and it remains to be seen when and where and by whom they will first be applied in any large scale.
F. 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 A. F in the A. F in the A with a D. With a D. F in the A. F in the A with a D. With a D. With a big fat D.
Actors pretend to have in order to win Oscars. Now, in real life, mental health can be something of a touchy topic. We don't like to talk about it much. And as one psychiatrist explains, when we do, we don't talk about it well.
Stigma still is a very big issue. It manifests itself in the ways that we think and talk about the mentally ill and in the terms, the words that we use to describe them.
For instance?
Wacko. Psycho. Cray-cray.
Okay, first, hearing a bearded middle-aged man use the term cray-cray may have already killed that word forever. It's like when your mom says something is on fleek. It's done. It's just over at that point. But second, he is right. Cray-cray is a terrible name to call someone with mental illness. Although, it is an excellent name for a cartoon crayfish who just won a scuttling contest. You did it, cray-cray! You won the race! The point is, we don't talk about mental illness well. Sometimes, even TV personalities with doctor in their names can get it disastrously wrong.
On the next Dr. Oz, everybody wants to know, am I normal or nuts? Should you be worried?
This behavior is... It's not normal.
Have you gone completely insane? I mean, sir, have you gone completely insane? Completely insane people go outside, suck on a rock, and bark at the moon.
What the f*** is wrong with you? Sucking on a rock and barking at the moon is not a sign that someone's mentally ill. It's a sign that they are a wolf with an iron deficiency. You're thinking of anemic wolves, Dr. Phil. You're getting confused. But perhaps the clearest sign of just how little we want to talk about mental health is that one of the only times it's actively brought up is, as we've seen yet again this week, in the aftermath of a mass shooting, as a means of steering the conversation away from gun control.
This isn't guns. This is about, really, mental illness.
In many of these shootings, we have people who have mental disturbances.
Do we need to do a better job in mental health? You bet we do.
Yeah, it seems there is nothing like a mass shooting to suddenly spark political interest in mental health. Although it's worth noting that Governor Huckabee's state got a grade of D- on mental health care while he was in office. And you can't lecture people on something you got a D- in. It's like passionately delivering a speech on proper English grammar by saying, we need to thunk better about how we does word stuff. We need to get it did. Of a mass shooting might actually be the worst time to talk about mental health. Because for the record, the vast majority of mentally ill people are non-violent, and the vast majority of gun violence is committed by non-mentally ill people. In fact, mentally ill people are far likelier to be the victims of violence rather than the perpetrators. So the fact we tend to only discuss mental health in a mass shooting context is deeply misleading. It would be like if the only time we talked about Coca-Cola, it were in the context of this.
I'm standing here with this ice-cold, thirst-quenching, deliciously satisfying Coca-Cola, and it actually tastes better. Now, more than ever, Coke is it.
Sure, that happened, and Coke was undeniably involved in it, but most cans of Coke are not that one, and it would be unfair if every time you thought of Coke, you thought of that. But if now is our only opportunity to have a public discussion about mental health, then perhaps we should do it. Because in 2013, an estimated 43.8 million American adults dealt with a mental illness. And an estimated 10 million of us suffer from a serious mental illness each year. 10 million! That's almost as many people as live in Greece. And most of us know a lot more about Greece than we know about our mental health system. Think about it, you know at least three things about Greece. Its economy is collapsing, Yanni's from there, and Greek yogurt tastes like the ice cream they'd make in a town where dancing is illegal. You know at least three. And when you look at how our current system deals with severe mental illness, you'll quickly realize it's a mess and it always has been. We used to lock people up in asylums, which were often so bad they were known as snake pits. And that doesn't sound like an attractive place to live, even if you're a snake. You'd want some kind of snake loft or snake bungalow. I don't know. I'm no real snake agent.
Get off, you will be my first hit.
ago, the AP found that nearly 125,000 young and middle-aged mental health patients were being placed in nursing homes. And it's not a great idea to just stick a young person in with some old people and then hope for the best. It's like casting Taylor Lautner in the new Best Exotic Marigold Hotel movie. It's unsuitable for everybody involved in it. And some states have been involved in something called greyhound therapy. And unfortunately, that does not mean getting to hug a trembling dog who's 98% bone and gristle. It's an even worse kind of greyhound, the kind with four wheels and a broken toilet.
This is Ross and Neal, the only state-run psychiatric hospital in southern Nevada. Ross and Neal has been accused of greyhound therapy, a practice critics call unthinkable. Discharging seriously ill patients too soon, then supplying them with a one-way bus ticket out of town.
I'm sorry, but you cannot just put people you'd rather not see on a bus to another city. If you could, that's how every breakup would end. Look, Greta, it's not you, it's me, but on the other hand, I think you're going to really enjoy your new life in Syracuse. And we have not even got into the most depressingly common place that people with mental illnesses can end up.
2 million people with mental illness go to state and local jails every year. That's meant there's now 10 times more people behind bars than in state-funded psychiatric treatment.
That is terrible. Finding out jails are our largest provider of mental health treatment is like finding out Lil Wayne lyrics are our greatest source of sexual education. No, Darren, you can't smack it up, flip it like a spatula. Where did you even learn that? What does it mean, flip it like a spatula? Would you like it if I did that to your mother? No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't, Darren. So don't say it. Justice system to treat the mentally ill isn't just ineffective, it's expensive and it's dangerous. Because often when someone is having a mental health emergency, the police will be called. And that can end tragically. By some estimates, an incredible half of all incidents involving the police use of deadly force involve a mentally ill person. And to their credit, some police departments are changing the way they do things, even creating special units like this one.
Right. These officers are experts in what's called crisis intervention training.
Would you say that you really don't want to die, but you want the pain to stop? Would that
be?
Okay. And you're willing to get some help today?
Yeah.
This woman agrees to get help.
We'll go in there together. You'll ride with us. We're in an unmarked car.
It's all part of a pioneering program where the mentally ill are diverted out of jails and into treatment.
Okay, well, that seems really good, but calling it a pioneering program is a little heartbreaking. Pioneering ideas should not be completely obvious things we should have been doing all along. They should be outlandish things that push the limits of the possible, like a fitted sheet that's easy to fold, or marshmallow airbags, or a sex doll without such judgy eyes. Don't look at me like that, Linda. I'm lonely and we both know it. Unfortunately, only 15% of law enforcement agencies even have crisis intervention training programs, let alone special units. And taking that training is typically voluntary. And how can something so essential to your job be voluntary? Take the mascot for the Tampa Bay Rays. We don't let him decide whether or not to wear that costume because without it, things can get ugly fast. It's important for doing his job right. And look, That's just a tiny fix. Our whole system needs a massive overhaul, which won't be easy. The public safety net for the mentally ill spans Medicaid, which is different across the country, 8 federal agencies who administer 112 different programs that in some way touch on mental health, and the social service agencies in each of the 50 states. It is a clusterfuck. Except that's an insult to clusterfucks. Because at least in them, there's the potential of a satisfying ending. This is more of a frustrating cluster dry hump of some kind.
Trying to transform me makes you my arch nemesis. I can only be me, nothing more, nothing less. Tattoos on my chest, rapping about selling sex. Yeah, I gotta scream, let it all out. Could be found dead from the words coming out my mouth. Ain't a gangster and never been a thug, but I sold a little drugs and I'll tear up the club. Bite my nails to the nub, middle finger stay up. 2 fucks for a slug and I'm still smoking. Bring me a wand, cause that girl hot. I bring the steam out your teapot, I am hip hop. Tip me over, little beauty, cause I am a beast. No matter what you say on the internet, I run a street. Yeah, I can only be me. Yeah, yeah, same old keys. Yeah, I can only be me. I can only be me. What you get is what you see. Yeah.
And that's not to say there aren't programs that work. Let's look at just one, assertive community treatment. It's designed to let those with serious mental illnesses live in the community by providing regular in-home visits and help coordinating assistance in things like housing and employment. Listen to just one social worker explain how it can work.
What makes mental health might not just be a visit to your psychiatrist. It might also mean having your entitlements in place, or it might mean having your rent paid on time. So instead of meeting with a person and talking about how they're doing, how they feel once a month or twice a month, what we do is everything that it takes to keep people in the community living independently.
That's fantastic. Everything it takes sounds like a much better option than what we've apparently been trying, which is nothing, not anything, very few things, not much, and prison. And yet, in many states, assertive community treatment programs are in jeopardy thanks to everything from budget cuts to Medicaid reimbursement problems. Despite the fact, a study found that these programs pretty much pay for themselves, which is fantastic. Government programs are like graduate students on a first date. If they are able to pay for themselves, it's a fucking miracle. And look, again, that's just one program. There are many more designed for many different levels of need. And we, as a society, we have to figure out how to fund them. Not just because it makes fiscal sense, but because it would save lives. And if I remember rightly, there are some politicians who claim to be pretty motivated to address this problem.
This isn't guns. This is about really mental illness.
In many of these shootings, we have people who have mental disturbances.
Do we need to do a better job in mental health? You bet we do.
Okay, fine. Do it then.
You can look at me. What'd you see?
Okay, well, I'm a witness here. What I seen was a horrible, tragic situation. The guy was coming down, and I guess the police was trying to do a stop point. The man said, no, not today, and they began to race behind each other like cats and dogs. The police officer got behind the man and started going so fast, his car spinned out of control. Girl, he hit the pole. His head went to one side, and his body went to the other side, and this is the result. Lord be with this young man. He need a blessing.
So what did you... Where were you when this happened?
Well, ma'am, I was actually going to buy me a piece of burger from Burger King. And I just stopped right in the middle because my hunger just went away. Because when I seen that accident, girl, I just began to be nosy. And I just had to just understand that somebody was experiencing this difficulty moment that was just not... Ma'am, I just cannot bear to continue to talk because it's just so...
Tell me what you saw. Did the police... Who hit
what? Well, what I seen was that the police officer was merging towards the front, and the car gunned a little right, and then the police officer kind of submerged, and both of them interacted, and it was a full twist about, and the police car just twisted around like a tornado, girl, and the Lord just shook it up, and the man just got injured. And now the result is, this police officer don't know if his life is going to continue to make it, or he going to just tap out.
What did you see the officer do? Did you see, you saw
they
him?
Yes, ma'am. The police officer called Fishtail. That's what happened. It Fishtail, ma'am.
What do you want to tell Mommy today? What do you want to say to Mommy?
Oh! Sounds like suicide.
Very powerful stuff. What more do you want?
For the heart, I subtract profanity. In my verse, I held the door open and let my lady go first. Yo, I raised a kid that had no father at birth. I rode my bike to work to preserve the earth and gave a buck to a bum that forgot his worth. I got water for a person that was dying of thirst. Said a prayer for the pastor that lost his church, trying to save a world that he knows is cursed. I revived the dead man driving a hearse, showed him the light as we both conversed. I show you forgiveness if you've done the worst. I speak the truth in each one of my words. Then I taught an addict how to fight the urge, inspire confidence in those that lack courage. It's who I am, I don't care if you notice me. This is how I live, cause this is how it's supposed to be.
Magic meeting, tender moment, led me to a world of bliss. Sweet expression, sounds of beauty, longer than
rhymes, always write and chalk, do it one verse at a time. I outline my thoughts, I put my foot in my mouth, walk in what I talk, but I won't put a sock in it to stop my chops. Stay moving in the shadows of doubt without fright. Learn to walk in the dark when my words shed light. As a kid I didn't like home, hung out in the park, knew there's a better place and was down to march. As a man exams, sits back and examines, wise as the owl, I know in what branch I'm standing. Don't care what you're planning, I follow my own dreams. I'll let you burn this tree down and watch me grow wings. A survivor through the fire and all the rains, I'll be a rider through the highs and all the pains. God knows why I came this far to tell you stories. I love rhyming, but there's things that's more important.
Magic meeting, tender moment, led me to a world of bliss. Sweet expression, sounds of beauty, longer than
that I embark. I used to follow greed, it didn't get me very far. To mend these scars, I'll begin where they start. I'll bleed my past into each of these bars. Remember long nights, awake in the dark, flame on the pipe, each feeling harsh, brought harm to myself, high feeling starved. My dreams and relations soon fell apart. She deserved better, I left her in the cold. I was selfish when I went off on my own. I chose dope over what mattered the most. I nearly lost it all, spinning out of control. Still she stuck by my side when I was all alone. She picked me up since I haven't been that low. If it wasn't for her, who knows where I'd go. What she means to me is beyond any word spoke.
Now, go find the others. .com.
Hey, it's all going to work out. Here's sports.